now. It's time for Playing with Fire with Chef Tom and Stu at the new 104.7 WHLI. Brought to you by Santa Giada Pinot Grigio.
But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell, and I'm broadcasting to all you foodies out there across Long Island. I'm here with co-host and producer, Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Tom. The weather is always on my mind lately.
Really?
I think we went from, I guess it was winter, right into summer.
I know, it's crazy. It's like, it seems to be less spring. I don't know if it's just my imagination or whatever, but last couple of years, it always seems to be, you know, a lingering winter and cold and windy, and then all of a sudden it's 80 and, you know, nice. So I guess I'm just grateful it's finally here, you know?
I mean, I get involved in so many different crazy things that I go anywhere from dining at Lutece to, you know, checking out the new taquito at 7-Eleven. And we just had a grand opening of a 7-Eleven right by the radio station on the corner of 110 and Conklin Avenue, and was outside yesterday, and I didn't realize it. I didn't have suntan lotion on. I came in with this huge red head.
Yeah, well, you got to, especially, you know, if you have a shaved head, you know, you got to be careful. You got to throw some tanning stuff up there. You know, I can tell sometimes my hair is probably thinner than it used to be, because every once in a while I'll get a spot up there that hurts, you know.
Cosmetics of stuff. You know, when I talk to people and I say, look, in the cosmetics of stuff, you know, when I talk to people and I say that I get to do a radio show with Tom Shardell, they always talk about the bandana. Uh-huh. And I'm sitting here thinking, it's been months, maybe 2 years of COVID, and I don't see you with a bandana anymore.
Well, you know, the bandana for me, it became this look. And it was all accidental. I mean, it started in Montauk, when I had the restaurant in Montauk in the early 90s. And I grew my hair out very long. My hair was like down the middle of my back. And I don't know, it was, you know, it was a moment or whatever. And basically, I used the bandana to keep the hair out of the food, you know. It's, you know, you get pulls on it or whatever, you know. So I tie it up in a ponytail, and I put a bandana on. And it was good as a sweatband also, because, you know, the kitchens where I work, I mean, it can get to be 130, 135 degrees back there, you know, and sometimes even hotter in the summer. So when you get, you know, like humidity in that 80, 90% range, and then, you know, the temperature in front of the ovens is, you know, in front of the ranges is pretty high, you know, you tend to have the sweat thing going on, and you certainly don't want that into anything. So it started out as, and it still is, it's a practical measure, you know, but it became an identifying thing with me, because I was always seen with it. So, you know, I was in a bookstore, I think it was about maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and I was standing online, and this little old woman came up to me. She had to be at least 80, 85 years old. And she goes, "You're that chef, right?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "You know, I almost didn't recognize you without that schmata on your head." You know? I just lost it laughing, you know. So cute. But, yeah, people always ask me, you know, "Hey, Tom, where's the bandana?" It's at work where I always wear it.
You know? It's funny. I think last week you nailed it. You were talking about your adventure at a bachelor auction, and you said you had this hippie biker look. And I really think you nailed it when you said that. And again, a lot of women are into that. So
it's probably a function of, you know, when I grew up or whatever. I don't know. You know, I remember when I was, you know, 18 or 19 years old, and I had very long hair, and, you know, it's the music scene and all of that stuff. And, you know, I still probably have about 2% outlaw in me anyway, you know. But I remember looking at these guys from who grew up in the 50s, still had the slick back hair and stuff, and thinking, wow, don't they look dated? And I'm sure this kid's looking at me now and go, God, that guy looks like he's old, you know, kind of thing. But it is what it is. I mean, I think you kind of always hang on to that, you know, that era or whatever. It's like even with music, you know. I find myself listening to some of the music I listened to as a kid, you know, which is what I really enjoy. You know, there's some music that I like, new music that I like, but I kind of shy away from it a little bit, and I always revert back to, you know, what I really loved growing up. And so I don't know. It's like we always talk about, you know, music and food have, and wine have that ability to freeze that moment in time for you, you know, like a photograph, so you can go back and visit it and take a look and remember. And It's just fun, you know.
It's interesting. So I don't get to see you pull up to the studios in your vehicle, mm-hmm. and in this persona, this imaging that I'm trying to put together here. So does Tom Shordell drive up like in a pickup truck?
Well, I do have a pickup truck. I had a big one for a while, and I kind of traded that down, and I bought this Hyundai Santa Cruz. And I have two cars. I have to have two cars because I do a lot of mileage. So it costs me the same amount to lease two as it would one if I, you know, had one. So it gives me options anyway. So I have, you know, I had a big pickup truck because I was doing a lot of catering at one point. It was helpful. Now I don't do as much as I used to. And turns out that I didn't need it. But, you know, I'm not a you know, Acura guy. I'm not a, you know, like
you're not a luxury guy. You're a...
Yeah, and
more earthy guy.
Yeah, or even a non-luxury guy. I'm not a you know, Accord, you know, kind of driver. So I have a Ford Edge. I was doing Explorers for a long time. I probably had four or five of those.
So you downsized a little bit.
And yeah, I went way down. I had an Escape for a while, and the guy kept calling it an Escape, and I was laughing, you know, when I was buying it. Anyway, but I got a little bigger, so I have a Ford Edge. I always had luck with Ford products. And I was going to buy a Ford pickup, and then, you know, they got so crazy expensive. And I saw this Santa Cruz, which is kind of like, it's like half passenger car. It's got a little bit of a thing in the back, you know, pickup thing in the back. And it's just enough to be annoying. I mean, you can't fit anything big in there, but you can throw your golf clubs in there. So that's what I'm driving these days.
It's all good. It's all good.
Yeah.
So, again, just to get into this thing, because I spent a lot of time at 7-Eleven, but I want to talk about technology and get your insight because, again, there's this brand-new top-of-the-line 7-Eleven that just opened up.
Right.
And I'm there at 6:30 in the morning for the grand opening, which I'll be remanded about because it's not a grand opening.
Oh, no?
It's a new store opening.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I guess it's not so grand.
Well, yeah. It's 1,000 times better.
But
yeah.
When I look behind the counter, the technology blew me away. So first of all, just as far as the consumer experience, there is now all these different machines that make fresh ground coffee, I guess like a latte or whatever.
Excuse me.
They have some machines that put flavor in. They have some machines that froth milk. Mm-hmm. There's a iced coffee bar with different strengths. And it's just crazy from that end.
Sure.
And to be honest, I don't know how anybody keeps up with. If the machine works, everything is good. If it doesn't, I don't know who they're calling. But I have this new slogan. Everything is good until it's not.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been the victim of technology malfunctioning for, you know, the last 25, 30 years, you know. Because we have a lot of computerized stuff at the restaurants. And, you know, I mean, the computer systems that, you know, add the checks and everything else. Not so much in the kitchen. But I can see, and my take on it is that everybody's about, you know, freaking out because there's no help. You can't find help. So the more you can automate, you know, the easier it's going to be on your business. That said, you know, those things never go down when they're slow. I've never had a machine go down on me on a Monday night. You know, it's always been Saturday night on a weekend when it's triple time to get the guys there. And I've always had a suspicion that, you know, if a 16-year-old kid can hack into the computer at the Pentagon, you know, these guys can program a machine to go down on a certain date.
But everything is so high-end. So... obviously 7-Eleven, and we're not going to spend the whole day talking about talking about 7-Eleven, but 7-Eleven is known for its Slurpee. Now there's a computerized Slurpee machine, so you start with I guess lemonade Slurpee or whatever, and then you can have raspberry flavor put into it, you can have mango flavor put into it. There's like everything's push button. It's crazy. And then their soda machine is the same thing. But what really got to me is there were all these different workers there setting up and everything. Next thing you know, they're all bakers and chefs. So they were making anything from wings and chicken skewers and baking cookies and making muffins. So are these like convection ovens they're using? What's going on there?
I don't know. I'd have to take a look. I mean, you know, it's like an air fryer. I mean, air fryer is basically a convection oven. It's not frying anything. It's convecting. It's, you know, blowing hot air around, you know.
They're making pizzas.
Yeah, well, you know, if you go to 7-Eleven for a pizza, you deserve what you get. You know? And it's no knock on 7-Eleven. I mean, there's, you know, obviously the successful is one on every corner, you know. But when I think pizza, it doesn't just 7-Eleven doesn't come up, you know.
So but you got to give them credit because a couple of years ago they tried to have a breakfast pizza, and it didn't work. But they tried.
I'm shocked. Yeah, you know, there's certain things that I think that, you know, we have this thing now. You're not allowed to co-opt somebody's ethnicity. It's you know, the whole political thing has gone so crazy that if an American opened up an Italian restaurant, they get, you know, excoriated online because they're culturally appropriating something, which is ludicrous. I mean, you know, you can learn a cuisine. I mean, you can have an Italian guy cooking Japanese food. I mean, you know, there's Japanese guys that have studied in Italy. What's the big deal? You know, shut up and, you know, go to work or whatever. But the bottom line is, you know, there's certain things that I think are sacrosanct. And if you're going to make good pizza, you should learn how to do it. It just doesn't seem to me that the ovens in 7-Eleven are going to, you know, it's... I guess it's a convenience thing.
The pizza that they offer there is like an Elio's. If anybody does supermarket shopping, it's on that type of thing. It's on some sort of breading, base. And
Then of course, it's like a frozen pizza.
Right. Yeah. But the other thing that I'm amazed at is I'm starting to think that when you purchase a 7-Eleven franchise, that you get either a Tesla, Mercedes, or BMW comes with it.
You had a role in the parking lot?
Ownership.
Well, it could take some money to buy a franchise, I would think. And most of them are run... There's a lot of Asian guys that own it, like Indian and Pakistani and...
Yes.
You know, and gas stations, too. I wonder what that is. I don't know if it's the cash thing or... You know, it's an odd thing. It's almost like, you know, there are certain ethnicities that gravitate towards, you know, Greeks with diners and, you know, the Pakistani or the Indians with the 7-Elevens. And I've always wondered why.
Something, you know, about just, you know, working hard, digging in and getting it done. I don't know.
Yeah, but why don't the Greeks have, you know, beauty parlors or something? I mean, they all work hard, for sure. It's just that there's certain ethnicities that have been drawn to certain things. I've never really figured out the reason. If somebody knows what it is, they can call up and educate me. But,
perfect segue.
Yeah.
So if you want to share some insight with us, fire@whli.com, fire@whli.com. And while I have the mic, we're coming upon Memorial Day weekend, and we'd love to have you, our listeners, share with us what you will be doing for Memorial Day weekend. Are you going to the air show at Jones Beach? Are you having a family gathering? Because, again, the past couple of years, it's sort of been low-key, very small gatherings.
And yeah.
We'll find out, I guess, if we're really out of this COVID thing.
I think it's becoming more like a head cold now, though. I mean, you know, it's not... people aren't terrified the way they were.
Just very contagious, but usually lightly felt. And as we were talking off-air... It seems like a lot of people are not sure if they have COVID or not, and they're actually being diagnosed with flu.
Well, you know, you can be sick, and it doesn't have to be COVID. I mean, that's the thing. Everybody's so paranoid, you know. I mean, I had either pneumonia or bronchitis a couple of weeks ago that I'm still feeling the effects of, and you know, it was COVID negative, you know. But I was, you know, I had COVID once. I guess about a year ago, whatever it was, and I was way sicker this time. And I don't get that stuff, you know. I'm kind of indestructible, pretty much. And it was like I was coughing like a dinosaur. It was like nuts, you know. It's like you're doing crunches, you know. I was coughing so much that my stomach hurt, you know, which indicates that I should be on a better exercise program. But anyway, it was crazy. I mean, I had antibiotics and all kinds of stuff, you know, cough drops. It was crazy. But it wasn't COVID, and, you know, you're allowed to be sick without having COVID, I think, you know.
Gotcha. So let's talk a little, as you say, a little food, a little wine, and then we'll take a break. But you were having an off-air conversation with Jesse, our chief technician and engineer here at the radio stations, and he came in and he was talking about un-oaked Chardonnay.
Yeah.
And you were going through that I guess in France, it's like very subtle something.
Yeah, well, in France, they produce a lot of Chardonnay in France, mostly in Burgundy, but in other regions also. And they do use barrel fermentation, which is oak barrels to ferment the Chardonnay in most of Burgundy. But they use they generally don't use new oak, you know, which imparts a much more stronger.
Well, you were saying that like France does it whatever it was very subtly.
Yeah.
Where California hits you over the head.
Well, I'm gonna preface these comments by saying this is my opinion, and it's not law, and I'm sure there are other people who have other opinions. But back around the 80s, I guess it was Kendall Jackson. Started making Chardonnays that were very heavily oaked, and they seemed to have had some unfermented juice back in, added back in, that would make them a little on the sweeter side. And the funny part about Americans is, you know, we talk dry, but we drink sweet. You know, we're so used to sugar in this country that it's a familiar flavor to people. And that flavor profile that Kendall Jackson started kind of hooked on to the American public, and they were selling oceans of that wine. The result was everybody looked around and went, wow, they're all drinking Kendall Jackson. I wonder why. And then they tasted the wine and go, okay, well, that must be what people wanted. And so all these other wineries started making wine in that similar vein that was very heavily oaked and a little sweeter than you would think. Anyway, so it turns out that I guess 20 years later, people started to get a little palate fatigue with that, and some of the winemakers in California were starting to back down on that oak, and some were starting to ferment Chardonnay in steel barrels instead of the oak casks. And so you had this unoaked Chardonnay, which produces a much cleaner, crisper, sort of acidic flavor that cuts through, you know, foods and things that it pairs with a little better, in my humble opinion, than the big oaky Chardonnays. And I didn't really drink Chardonnay for a long time other than white Burgundy because I was just, it wasn't my thing. I just didn't like the flavor profiles. And it wasn't until Richie from Roanoke Vineyards, I did him a favor and he wanted to repay me. So he says, hey, can I give you a bottle of Chardonnay? I'm like, why, are you mad at me? You know, kind of thing. And he started laughing. He goes, you don't like Chardonnay? I said, no, I'm just kidding, you know. He goes, I got a bottle of Unoak. We're making some Unoak Chardonnay. Why don't you check it out? And I did, and I loved it. It was great. And I'm like, wow, more people should be doing this. And it turns out they are. So when you see, you know, the interesting thing to do if you want a little wine experiment is to go to, you know, a place like Stu Leonard's or some a reputable wine shop, or you know, even Total Wine. They have a million wines over there in Westbury. But you go to shop and get an oaked and an unoaked Chardonnay and drink them side by side, and you'll see the difference between the two. And you may prefer the other one. It doesn't matter, you know.
And that's very interesting. I wish I remembered, but I know we have a friend that is very into Kendall Jackson Chardonnay.
Yeah.
And when I went downstairs to Stu Leonard's, there was like two options on Kendall Jackson,
yeah, of course.
And I don't remember what they were, but I this is really strange. While we're sitting here, I Googled. There's a Vinter's Reserve Chardonnay.
Yeah.
There's something else, but this, and there's an un-oaked Chardonnay that they do, but this is the one that blows me away. There's a K-J low calorie California low calorie Chardonnay.
Yeah, I'll pass on that.
WTF?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's, you know, there's all kinds of stuff coming out now, gimmicky wines. You know, we get sparkling wines in a can now, you know, for the beach or whatever. And you know, and listen, there's an ass for every chair. You know, there's a market for everything. So, you know, the bottom line is I'm personally a little more serious about wine than the average bear, I guess, you know. But I see the value in those things. I mean, you know, people want to drink a little less caloric. Great. You know, you want a little less alcohol in your wine. Great. You know, I prefer lower alcohol reds than higher alcohol reds for a number of reasons. But, you know, when you talk California wines, a lot of those reds are very, very high in alcohol content, you know, 14, 5, 15% alcohol, which is high. And it's not their fault. They get so much sun that the ripeness and the sugars get so ripe that the alcohol is higher. You know, on the East Coast here, most of the wines are like 12.5 to 13.5, which is a little less. And, you know, even some of the whites, like when you get to the Finger Lakes, you know, you can find Rieslings that are 11% alcohol, even less than that. And it's great because you can have two or three glasses and not walk into the walls on the way to the refrigerator, you know.
So, again, I'm intrigued by the Kendall Jackson website. They talk about one of their varieties is very lush tropical fruit intertwines with lemon, lime, and floral. There's another one that they talk about, candied lime and vanilla creme brulee. What's the go-to definition of flavor of a Chardonnay? Is it a very fruity, sweetish?
It's an opinion thing, and it depends on who made it. You know, I mean, the fact that they're talking creme brulee and vanilla tells me it's sweeter than the average Chardonnay, you know? I don't know. You know, people, they throw these adjectives around. I don't really think anybody knows what they mean. I mean, I get the vanilla thing. You know, I've tasted that in Chardonnays. I get the oak. You know, I get people say, you know, it tastes like lead pencil. I'm like, I don't know. I never ate one. You know what I mean? How would you know what lead pencil tastes like?
Haven't you gnawed on a pencil when you were in grade school?
Yeah, but never, not the lead, the wood, you know?
you're right. Yeah. That's definitely, I'm glad you clarified.
And I get people say, you know, that Cabernet is so tensile. I'm like, I had to look it up. I'm like, you know, tense. Here's a great example, right? I have a friend of mine. He's a very knowledgeable wine guy. He had a wine shop. I don't want to tell you where it is. Doesn't matter. But he's retired now. And he was a teacher. So him being a teacher, he teaches. You know, he doesn't talk to you. He teaches you when he talks to you, you know, which is painful sometimes because he doesn't always know what he's talking about, right? So we're at this wine tasting in the city. It was Windows of the World. It was a million wines there, the Milk Wine Experience, it's called, right? So he's funny. He's always the first one there and the last one to leave, right? He's got his pencil and paper. He's very studious, and I don't do that, you know. When I go to the wine tastings, I don't really look at the book because I don't want to be poisoned by the price or whatever. I just want to taste the wines, get the ones that really get me. Then I'll go back to the book and find out who has them and whatever. Anyway, so we're tasting these wines, and we're in Sancerre, right? And Sancerres are basically, the whites are Sauvignon Blanc, right? So he goes to me, Tom. And I said, yes, Ted? He goes, is that Bosch pear? Or Anjou pear in the back of that Sancerre? I'm like, you have some pear even asking me that because you wouldn't know the difference between a Bosch pear and an Anjou pear if I hit you with it, you know? So I think you know, in people's zeal to describe wine, they just, I think they go off the rails sometimes looking for things, you know? There's a barnyard quality to that, you know? It tastes like, there's a great description of New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs, and they tend to be a little grassy and sometimes over-the-top tropical fruity, but sometimes people describe them as having the flavors of cat pee, you know? And I'm like, you know, that's not really a selling point, you know, if I'm not mistaken. And so I think that, you know, again, I just want to restate, in the zeal to try and describe a wine, you know, people can get a little out there, you know? Tar and leather. Have you ever chewed on tar or leather?
Yeah. I have chewed on leather, I will admit.
I'm not even going to ask, but what the circumstances
were. I guess like if I had leather laces or something and I was trying to pull it through something, it would have a reason to be in my mouth, but I don't know. But you just mentioned something about Bartlett and Anjou pears. So I was in the supermarket the other night. I had this desire to get some fruit, and I'm looking at the Anjou pears and the Bartlett, and I didn't know what the difference was. I mean, there's a little different shape. So again, I'm at beck and call of Google, and I'm shocked to say the biggest difference between these two pear varieties is that the Bartlett turns yellow and when it's ripe, and the Anjou stays green. Well, that's not what I was looking for.
No, they
like,
both taste,
what's the difference in the taste?
Yeah, they both taste remarkably like pears. You know what I mean?
Thank you.
Yeah, I know. It's look, you know, if I was going to choose between the two, I would squeeze them, and the softer one would be mine. You know what I mean? Because you get these pears, and it, you know, they grow them in wherever they grow them this time of year, because pear season isn't really till the fall. And they're out there, and it's like they got a crunch of an apple.
But
you know?
And that's interesting, because I guess I like it a little a little firmer.
Yeah.
I don't like to eat my pear with a spoon.
No, no, or in a car.
And they move quickly. Yes, there's nothing worse
terrible
than going into the lunch bag and pulling out a pair that's really mushy, and I'm trying to drive.
No, there's three things you absolutely can't eat in a car. One is a pear. Two is a peach, if they're both ripe. And the third one is any sandwich that you bought at a deli, because they never cut it all the way through.
But is that why they call it, they invented wraps, because it's more mobile?
No, they don't cut the wraps through either. They never cut through the bottom. So you pick up the sandwich, the other half kind of comes with it, and it dumps all the roast beef or whatever you have all over your lap every time. You know, it's like nuts. They do the same thing at bagel stores, you know?
Absolutely.
It's painful, anyway.
Absolutely. And that reminds me, behind the scenes here at the radio station, when Tom gets here, he'll usually go to the kitchen area and get himself a coffee or a water or a Snapple or whatever. So we had bagels a couple of weeks ago, and Tom takes one of these bagels and he's slathering it with cream cheese, but it was whipped butter.
Oh, that was a mistake, yeah. I was all greased up for the next 2 days. It's terrible. Well, listen, let's take a little break. We'll sell some advertising here. We'll come back and we'll chat a little bit more.
Hi, this is Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander and the founder of Savorian Wines, a local import wine company. This week, I recommend King's Flower Provence Rosé. King's Flower comes from the world's best region for rosés. It's not too sweet and not too dry, the perfect combo for summertime. You can find a bottle of King's Flower Rosé at Stu Leonard's Wines in Farmingdale and Ryan's Wine in East Meadow. For more quality wine suggestions, just email me at chad@savorian.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI and 104.7 WHLI FM, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shawdell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
Yes, and, you know, chatting about, unoaked wines and stuff, and while we're on the subject of that, you know, I've been tasting some really interesting white wines lately that a lot of people don't normally shop for. And, you know, I'd just like to talk about them briefly and give people some insight to what they, you know, kind of what they taste like. But to try and encourage you to expand your wine palate a little bit. You know, a lot of people, the default wine is Pinot Grigio or Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc. Those are probably the three most popular for most folks out there. But there's a whole sea of wine out there that's completely different. And some of the grapes are maybe some that you haven't heard of. There's a great grape called Fiano d'Avellino, F-I-A-N-O-D-I, Avellino, A-V-E-L-I-N-O, I guess it is. And just an interesting white wine. It has a little bit more of a yellow, straw yellow color and flavors of... you know, some tropical fruit and stuff, but it's just really interesting drinking these things. You know, Rieslings, again, it's a little more popular, but they come in all different degrees of dry and sweetness, from bone dry to, you know, absolutely dessert wine, so that you can put on pancakes.
So, yeah, I love this this orientation you're providing for us. I mean, I cheat. If I know I'm going to a restaurant, if it's a Mediterranean restaurant, if it's Italian or whatever,
yeah,
I might go to Tom and I say, you know, what should I try? Because I really do try to increase my universe of wine knowledge and tasting. But the our listeners, again, going back to this fire at WHLI.com, if you're going somewhere or want a suggestion on wine or want to make a comment on something, please use this channel to get to Tom and get his expert opinion and suggestions or even an explanation of something for you to make your dining experience or your wine tasting experience that much more knowledgeable and enjoyable.
Yeah, I'd be happy to help anybody out in that regard. I mean, I've sacrificed my body and liver for everybody else's education here. But, you know, the funny thing is that there's another grape that I've been drinking a lot of lately, and a lot, you know, a bottle here or there, whatever, is Vernaccia. And Vernaccia is another fun grape from Umbria. You know, there's a lot of Vernaccia in Umbria, and it just has that steely, minerally kind of flinty flavor that's kind of real good with seafood. And
I got to go back to earlier in the show, flinty. Flavor. How many times have you sucked on a piece of flint?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. I chew on rocks. That's how tough I am. But it does. It has that slaty kind of, you know, you can smell slate when it gets wet, you know, kind of like wet concrete.
In all seriousness, when I think of slaty, isn't slate like almost muddy or
it's kind of grayish,
earthy?
You know, I think of flavors and colors, and that's because I'm half a psycho half a
so
chef.
Use some synonyms or try to explain that. So slaty, flinty, what more understandable would somebody associate those taste, the flavor with?
Like wet rocks. Sometimes, you know, after a storm in the summer, you know, rocks, if you're around rocks in the backyard or whatever, they do have a little bit of a smell to them. And like concrete sometimes. It has that, you know, because the smell and the taste are the same. I mean, you know, the flavors, you know, you can smell something, you know, smell lilacs, you'll taste them, whatever. It's, you know, it's an interesting correlation. And I really believe that the sense of smell is one of the most privileged in the body, you know. It's another thing that can take you back. I mean, we had a lilac tree on the corner of my block when I was a kid. And every time I smell a lilac, I go right back to Carl Road, you know, in Carl Place. And it freezes that minute for me.
Boy, that brings back some memories. I used to live in Old Westbury, and I guess on the property line, I had a stockade fence, but I had an alternating line of forsythia and lilac. I guess it's like shrubs or whatever call it,
sure.
Bushes. And yes, I mean, to me, it was the greatest because the forsythia in spring gave you that yellow flower leaves, which was incredible. And then you went into the sensory experience of the lilac, and that it brings back incredible memories.
Oh yeah, those smells are just, you know, from your childhood. I remember even, you know, growing up in my my grandmother's kitchen, you know, the smells. When I smell roast pork, I go right back to Flushing and, you know, 58th Road and the house that she had there. It was just the memories of food and you know, forget wine for a moment, because as a kid you don't drink much of it, hopefully, but as an adult, I mean, you know, I go back to those memories. They're all so warm and you know, there's a familial family, you know, innocence, that time when you were a kid, 5, 6, 7 years old. And I also think that's why a lot of people who aren't involved in the food business, like, you know, I've been lucky enough to eat in some of the finest restaurants in the world and multiple times. I've tasted just about everything that's available. So my perspective is a little different than the average person. But I see that people tend to eat the foods that they ate as a kid. It's almost like when we listen to music, you know?
So my mind wanders. You always talk about your parents and being fairly simple.
Yeah.
Your mother's heritage, I think you said
Liverpool.
From England. And I guess England's not necessarily known for its incredible food.
That's a nice way of putting it.
So my mind wanders when we talk about memories and growing up in your household.
Yes.
What wine or liquor or beer, what was the experience for social drinking of your parents, and how does that bring you to where you are today?
My father was primarily a beer drinker. He used to flirt with old fashions every once in a while in Manhattans, but rye turned him into a different guy, you know what I mean? So he was smart enough to go back to beer. He got into wine later in his life, only because he had a heart attack, and, you know, they said it was good for him, whatever. My mother was basically, she's a jug wine chick. You know, she'll...
You've mentioned that. That's right. That's
cute.
Right.
You know, she drinks, like, Gallo Haughty Burgundy or something, you know. She had buy these big jugs of wine. So for her, I think it was more the buzz than the taste. You know, I mean, she would add some seltzer to it or whatever, cut it down, have spritzers or whatever. That was
now, that's
thing.
Incredible. This is totally unscripted. So I was at a local restaurant last night, Alyssa's in North Belmore. We had a birthday party for somebody. And they say, what do you want to drink? And when I'm in an Italian restaurant, I my mind goes many times to Chianti, a red wine. And it was good. It was very thick, for lack of a better description.
Mm-hmm.
And I put some cubes in it, and it diluted it a little bit. I actually put a little water into it, and it just hit my sweet spot. It just and I'm not being sugary when I say that. It just hit what I was looking for,
right.
And I was intrigued because I almost was chagrined talking to you about this because I feel I'm going to get reprimanded for diluting the wine, but it just hit the spot.
You know, I feel about that like I feel about ketchup on steak. Meaning that once you buy it, you can do whatever you want to it. I could care less. I it's your stuff. You eat it the way you want, drink it the way you want. You know, my mother would come to my house and she said, "Do you have any wine?" Which is the most ridiculous question she could probably ask me. Yeah, I have like 2,500 bottles. Would you like a couple, you know, kind of thing? So she said, "Well, what kind of wine do you have?" I said, "Well, what do you want? You know, well, I usually drink the whatever, Chablis, you know, Mountain Chablis." It's like hilarious. Mountain Chablis. It's made in California somewhere on a huge farm. Anyway, so I said, "Well, I have Chablis, but I don't think it's what you think it is." You know what I mean? So I bring up, you know, a bottle of Chablis, which, you know, my cost is probably in the $40-$50 range, you know. And I give her a glass. And she'll go, do you have any ice? I said, yeah, I got some ice. Could you give me a couple of cubes? Yeah, I get a couple of cubes. Okay, good. Do you have any seltzer? Yeah, I have seltzer. Could you put a little seltzer in it? You know, I'm thinking, if you wanted a spritzer, you know, you should ask me for one. It's hilarious, you know. But again, at the end of the day, I'm happy that she's happy. If that's what makes you happy drinking, then go get them. You know?
So you just said Chablis. How does Chablis compare to Chardonnay?
Chablis is Chardonnay.
Okay.
Chablis is an area, you know. It's like Burgundy, you know.
Okay.
So, it's the Chardonnays that are made in that area. Now, typically, we go back to the un-oaked conversation. Typically, Chablis are made without oak. They're fermented in steel barrels. And they tend to be crisper and leaner than the oak, you know, because the oak, it gives it a fattiness, or like you were saying before, a thickness to it, you know. And a lot of people like that style. I mean, I love Chablis.
Am I allowed to say thickness, or should I be saying body?
You say whatever you want. You know, just don't curse. You know, that's all. Once you get towards the body, I get a little nervous, you know.
So now you got my mind wandering like crazy here. So if Tom Shordell was of age that we are now, but back in the 50s, the late 50s, early 60s, I got to believe that the wine scene, the liquor store business model was so different than it is today. I mean, you go into a wine shop and there's hundreds and hundreds of wines. Some of it, I guess, appeal to the consumer by notoriety of what it actually is. Right. And the craziness of today's world, just like with perfumes, the label is what's selling somebody on something, or the creativity of the name.
Sure.
But it had to be so different back in the day, because just like vodka was vodka, there wasn't peach, there wasn't watermelon, it was just one.
Yeah, you had three brands. You had Smirnoff, Pop Off, and Get Off.
Right, whatever. So I wonder how it was back in the day.
Well, I can't really tell you about the late 50s because I was a little kid then, so I wasn't doing much shopping. But I can take you to the like late 60s when I started working in restaurants. I mean, you know, the steak pub craze was going on back then. You know, Cookies and Beefsteak Charlie's and all those guys, right? They had the big salad bar. We used to call it the trough, you know, salad trough. And, you know, nine dressings all made in some commissary in New Jersey and, you know, bad lettuce and tomatoes or whatever. But anyway, they all had that English pubby look, you know. That was the big thing back then. And all I remember was Matus bottles, empty Matus bottles everywhere. They had Matus Rosé. It was just rosé that was made in Portugal.
Is that still made?
I haven't seen a Matus Rosé in probably 25, 30 years. But so I don't know, honestly. It's not what I
Because my mind goes to, yes, there used to be the Matus bottle, which was like a sideways oval with a spout.
Yep.
And an Amaretta, which is not called Amaretta anymore.
Yeah.
It's a Di Serono.
Di Serono. Well, that's the producer. But, you know, the thing is, yeah, the wine selection was minimal at best, and it was a lot of jug wine back then. I mean, you know, people ordered a white wine. They didn't really know what it was. They didn't care about a grape. And then, you know, it started to evolve, you know. And the biggest transformation in America, I think the year was 1976, where they had what they call the Judgment of Paris. And the Judgment of Paris was like, I think it was 7 or 8 wine writers that we're going to blind taste American and French wines against each other. And it was Montelena, Chateau Montelena Chardonnay, that actually won the Judgment of Paris, much to the chagrin of a bunch of French people who were, like, horrified at the thing. And I don't remember the red wine. I want to say it was Silver Oak, but that's probably wrong. But there was a red wine that came in very highly regarded also. And so it was the shot heard around the world. It was all of a sudden, oh, wow, they can make really good wine in California. We had no idea. And that started to grow, and more people started to go out there and, you know, and take these vineyards that had been producing grapes for the masses for all those years and started to get more serious about other types of wines, Cabernets and Chardonnays and stuff. And it just grew and grew and grew until now it's, you know, wine is a thing. My daughter is, you know, I don't want to tell you how old she is because A, she'll get mad at me, and B, it'll age me. But even as a kid, when she was 22, 23, 24, her and her friends were drinking some interesting wines. Now, granted, you know, they all work for me, her and her friends, you know. We tried to keep them out of trouble, giving them a job. But, you know, they were into it. They were into wines. It wasn't just like, hey, let's go get beers and shots of Jägermeister or whatever.
So
you know?
When did California get its notoriety? Because, I mean, it would seem that Europe was the start of...
So it started over there. Well, 76 was when they had the big, you know, that Judgment of Paris where the American wines
came in. And it got it some respect.
It got respect over here and it angered a whole bunch of people over there because they couldn't believe it, you know. The French tend to be a little proud of, you know, the little that they do, you know, like cheese and wine, you know. And it's fine because they make great wines and great cheeses. But, you know, it was proven that, you know, the great part about blind tasting, when you don't know what the wines are, is you pick the wine that you think is the best. You pick the wine that you like the best. You're not poisoned by the label. You're not poisoned by the price. I've gone to blind tastings where Eric, I think of his last name now, but he was the winemaker at Bedell for a long, long time. Eric, it'll come to me. Eric Fry. And... he used to make these old vines Chardonnay and old vines Merlot, which meant that the vines were very mature. Probably, you know, with Long Island, how mature could they be? Maybe 20 years or 15 years at the time. But anyway, he would put his wines up in a blind tasting against Petrus, which is probably the most expensive Merlot in the world, and Chateau, Margaux, or one of the first growth Bordeaux. And you tasted them blind against each other. Now, to give you a little background, his wines were about $50 a bottle at the time, and the two French wines were probably in the $1,000-$1,500 a bottle at the time. Right? And I remember going to several of those tastings and tasting the wines back and forth and having a hard time deciding which one was which. And you have a 50-50 shot, so it's a little easier than if you had 10 of them, right? And I remember rating them. I actually liked his Merlot better than the Petrus. Which,
really?
You know, I said to him, if I drink yours instead of that one in 10 years, I can afford a Ferrari, you know. And I liked the Chateau Margaux a little better than his Cabernet. But it wasn't like I rated 185 and the other 196. It was like 92, 93, you know, against 91, 90. You know, it was very close, you know.
And how blessed are we here on Long Island that Long Island has become known for its own regional wines.
Sure.
Coincidentally, the Finger Lakes in upstate New York also. But are there other regions across the country? The only thing that really comes to mind, and Oregon is known, for some wines.
Yeah, Pinot Noir.
Maybe Seattle?
Yeah, Washington makes a great wine. Well, there's wine made in every state now.
Is there really?
Yeah, one of the best sparklers I know is made in New Mexico. So, you know... Virginia has a thriving wine business. Connecticut is starting to make some wines. I've had wines from Rhode Island. I've had wines in Massachusetts, Michigan. Trying to think of the bigger ones. There's Idaho has a...
And I thought you would laugh at me if I used in my example, you know, like, you don't find wine in Michigan, and here you are saying there's wine made in Michigan.
There's wine made in every state in the United States at this point. Now, I'm a little worried about the Hawaiian wine, you know what I mean?
That's going to be with ham and pineapple.
Yeah,
right?
it'd be great to, you know, pair with one of those pizzas, you know. And Alaska, it probably tastes like salmon or something, or king crab. But... you know, it's interesting to watch these things evolve. And, you know, I've had great wines from Virginia, you know. There's good wine everywhere. There's really no bad wine anymore, which is, you know, how lucky are we now? I mean, we're in a golden age of winemaking. You know, technology's caught up with the grape. And it's hard to make a bad wine. You may have preferences, you know, like one over the other. I don't like that. You say that Chianti was a little stronger than you'd like. Chianti is basically Sangiovese. That's the grape, you know, Sangiovese or Sangiovese Grosso, one of the two. And they're both very similar, a little different. But anyway, the bottom line is that's the thing about, you know, the wine today is, you know, go out and check them out. Like I started to tell you before, you know, go taste two wines against each other. Or, you know, now a lot of restaurants have better wine by the glass selection, which allows you to, you know, at the expense of maybe $12, you can try something and maybe not like it and be okay, rather than buying a bottle for $65 and go, oh, that was a mistake, you know. So I understand that. But I've always said the best way to educate yourself is to go to a reputable wine shop with an amount of money that you're comfortable with, whether it's $100 or $1,000, and say, listen, pick me out 6 wines or 12 wines and just mix them up. Give me 3 whites and 3 reds, or 6 whites and 6 reds, or whatever. And just, you know, just give me some interesting things that I haven't had before. Here's what I tend to drink, and here's kind of what I like. And if you go to a Stu Leonard's or a Total Wine, most of those guys are pretty knowledgeable, so they'll be able to steer you in a direction, and you take them home and check it out. You know, I started talking about wines that I drink, that white wines that I drink that aren't all that popular, like Fiano d'Avellino, or Greco di Tufo, or Silvaner, or Mueller Turgau. I had a beautiful Mueller Turgau the other night, you know. And it's just, these wines are under the radar. They're generally less expensive than the all the usual suspects, like the Chardonnays and the Sauvignon Blancs. And they're just gorgeous little wines that are made by little artisans. And, you know, a lot of these guys still have their hand in the vineyard. They're not manufactured like Kendall Jackson. There's nothing wrong with drinking Kendall Jackson. I don't want to knock them. But they produce vast amounts of wine.
Is Kim Crawford a similar...
Well, that's New Zealand, you know.
Oh.
So it's a different flavor profile.
I thought that was California. No, see how unknowledgeable I am?
Yeah, I see that. Well, that's why I'm here.
You know? Thank you.
But anyway, the bottom line is, you know, I don't want to knock anybody's efforts, but a lot of these wineries that have the big names, and I don't have to mention them. You'll know them if you see them. But they were very, very good wines in the 80s, right? And then what happened was the winemaker got older and decided to retire, or the owner of the vineyard, and the kids didn't want to be farmers, so he had nobody to leave it to. So they would sell these vineyards out to General Mills or Gallo or some big conglomerate for X amount of million dollars, right? So now the conglomerate has to get that money back. So they start manufacturing a lot more wine, and it's made in a different way.
It's so interesting you're talking about this, because I have some clients and friends that are into alcoholic beverages, more whiskeys and bourbons, right, and stuff. And there's something known as Whistle Pig or something.
Yeah,
and they talk about that the founder died and now it's not the same and this, that, and the other. But that whole category of libations is crazy. I had a project the other day. We have a friend who's going through some really crazy things, and friends of his helped him by providing a private jet to take his wife home because of health issues up north from Florida. And he wanted to pay them back. And he goes to me, Stu, I really need to get 2 bottles of this Pappy Van Winkle.
Oh, yeah.
I need to get the 20-year. And it's not just one. It's 2 brothers that helped me out. I got to really do this for them.
Yeah.
He goes, there's no budget. And he says, but it's probably going to come in around $5,000 a bottle.
I don't think it's that high.
And actually, it was $3,600 what he bought it for. I found it for $4,600,
right.
But I'm just not clear on, you know, again, buying a bourbon. I guess it depends on what you're into. Like, you might buy a Chateau Marmont or something.
Yeah, I don't know that vineyard, but yeah, I might.
it's the new Stu vineyard that I'm putting together.
Where's it made? Farmingdale. Tuesday, 4:00.
Hey, listen, you told me there's a different region for wine everywhere now.
There is. Well, you know, some of these booze things are getting crazy. I saw a bottle of scotch for $35,000. You know, and those wines and those liquors are made for people who can afford them. And, you know, I always laugh. You know, I'm on a guitar site on the computer. There's one of his guitar sites. And there's a guitar maker. His name is Paul Reed Smith. And he makes really, really phenomenal guitars, you know. They're almost gorgeous pieces of furniture. You don't even want to, you know, play them so much. But they're good players. They're, you know, I have a few of them, and they're great players. They sound great. And I hear all these guitar players knocking the Paul Reed Smith, and you just know what it is. They can't afford it. You know, some of these guitars are $12,000, $13,000, so they get up there, and I get it, you know? But it's like, you know, people knock a Ferrari. Oh, Ferrari, I can just get there in a Volkswagen. Yeah, but not in the same time frame, you know? It is, there's certain things that are made for certain people, and it's okay. You know, it's okay to make, you know, DRCs, like Domaine de Normanie Conti, which is probably the most expensive property in the world. They make very little wine, and it's $4,000 or $5,000 a bottle, you know? Am I going to buy a bottle? Probably not. But there's guys out there that can afford it. So what's the big deal?
It's always nice to have a friend that has that bottle of wine.
Yeah, of course.
And wants to share it.
I mean, I tasted them. I've had them. I've had them when they were less expensive. But, you know, the bottom line is, I don't know what this eat the rich thing is all about. You know, if somebody made a bunch of money and wants to buy a Ferrari, let him buy a Ferrari. Who cares, you know? He's supporting people who are making the stuff, you know?
My only comment about that is, it goes back to, like, design of clothing. Is it more important to the person to have the label on the inside or on the outside?
Right.
I like to please myself. If I could afford this $10,000 bottle of wine that you're talking about, it would be great because I could do it. But I don't need to brag about it.
I get that part. But you know, the Ferrari sticker is on the outside of the car. I mean, so you can't buy one without it. You know what I mean? So what's the big deal? I just, you know, as long as you made your money legally, I have no issue. Go get them. It's America. You're supposed to do that.
Well said.
You know, I mean, if you're screwing people, it's a different story. Obviously, you're a criminal and you should pay for that. But, you know, the bottom line is I know a lot of people who are very wealthy and made their money legitimately through hard work and dedication and effort and all of that. And I hear it knocked all the time, and it just PO's me, you know what I mean? Because, you know, I know how hard these people, the time they put in. You know, you have other people who sit around on bar stools, you know, their whole life going, yeah, that guy, man, he would have listened to me. I had a boss. He's an idiot. I know. Yeah, okay, fine. But, you know, did you put in 80 hours a week like some of
us
did?
Well, there's always that discussion. I remember many times reading GQ when I was growing up. And, you know, do you need 10 pair of shoes or one really good pair of shoes? And I love that motivation to be able to buy that expensive pair of shoes and enjoy it and not the need to have, you know, 10 pair or something else.
And what about supporting all the workers that make all of this stuff? You know, somebody's making the yachts. You know, it's not one yacht guy who just says, here's a yacht. There's guys who are drilling. There's guys who are designing. There's guys who are plastering this, you know. I mean, come on, man.
But and it goes back to your philosophy and the industry that you're in. You know what? Maybe somebody goes to the local deli for his dinner every night and grabs a roast beef sandwich or a turkey sandwich. And then at the same time, he's doing that because when his wife's birthday comes, he wants to experience a restaurant that has an ambiance. It has a different quality of food that he would normally have. But he's creating a special opportunity for him to enjoy with someone he loves.
Yeah, of course. And he's also, again, you know, everybody looks at me like the rich restaurateur. I'm not. I promise you. You know, there's not a lot of money in it anymore. And, you know, but, you know, how many people have we sent on the American dream path, you know, who started as dishwashers? You know, your money that's coming in, it's not only supporting me. It's supporting everybody there. You know, I've had kids that come over from El Salvador. Didn't speak the language. I had one guy, Marbin, who came to me at 15 and started as a dishwasher. He's running a $5 million catering operation at the moment. That's pretty cool. You know what I mean? That's America. That's what we're supposed to be doing. We're not supposed to be whining about, I didn't get this for free, and how come I can't get that for free? And, you know, it's just, it's turning into a, this is turning into a rant, and I'm
no,
sorry.
No, but the reality is, you know, to be a man of means, again, not to whine about something, but if there's an issue in your life, be it a health issue, this, that, or the other, if you try to remedy it, you might get to where you need to be. You might not, because there's always going to be a positive path and a negative path, but why not always stream to be on that positive path and try and make the attempt?
It's funny, comical to me is that politicians have been trying to legislate equality forever, right? And the you know, political turd in the punch bowl, as they say, is that you have some people are ambitious and some people are lazy, and some people are smarter and some people aren't. Some people are, you know, industrious and some people could care less. Some people are humble and some people are Yankee fans. You know what I mean? It's just, it is what it is. And you know, you're going to have that shaken out, you know. But why do we have to dumb down all the successful people because the unsuccessful people didn't make it? America was always the land of opportunity. It wasn't the land of guarantees. Nobody comes into this world guaranteed to have anything. If you want to go after it, and the beauty of this country is you're allowed to do that.
It goes back to what you always say during the show. You know, not everybody can be a winner. You know, just like in today's mentality and sports for kids,
yeah,
you know, everybody has to get the trophy.
Ridiculous.
But again, in life, people are going to get bad hands. You know, it's not always going to go your way. But, you know, hopefully you find the negative as the empowerment to try to better.
And find your path. I mean, you know, if you're not the fastest kid in the class, you know, maybe you shouldn't be running. Maybe you should be playing a saxophone. There's something out there for you. You know, find your path and go for it.
And the truth is, if you're a good person, if there's something lacking in your life, but you're a good person and sort of living life without reciprocation, you never know. There might be somebody there to help you along because you were just being the person that is a good person.
Yeah, you know, I reconnected with a kid that I grew up with. I met him when I moved to Carl Place at 4 or 5 years old. He was my first friend, and we were inseparable until he met Melody Alonji when he was 12, and then he dropped me like a prom dress, you know what I mean, with his first girlfriend, you know. But anyway, Steve was a real good athlete. He had a tryout for the Pittsburgh Pirates. You know, he was a really talented baseball player, a good football player. And you know, anyway, so I hadn't seen him in years. And he called me up and asked me to help him out with this fundraiser he was doing with his wife over at Eisenhower Park. So I said, yeah, sure, I'll get you some food or whatever. And so he came in with his son. His son was a real successful kid, went to West Point, you know, just a great A, great family, you know. And he said, oh, my dad said, you guys grew up together, you used to play football all the time. I said, you know, your father was a great athlete. You know, he was a way better athlete than me. He goes, yeah, he mentioned that. I said, did he mention I was a way better guitar player than him? You know, and that's kind of what it was, you know what I mean? Everybody finds their area of expertise unless you're just, you know, expecting everybody to do it for you and you're lazy and, you know. And if that's the case, then you kind of deserve your lot, you know, to some degree. We like to see everybody successful, but it's not going to happen, you know. And you can't legislate it, which is the comical part of politics, is they're trying, and it's failed all the time, you know. Anyway, enough of that. So anyway, we're at the end of the show.
We are. I just want to thank quickly Savorian Wines for being the sponsor of our show. I think there's a wine that we're showcasing today in their messaging on their advertising with us, King's Flower Rosé.
Nice.
But thank you, Savorian Wines, and... how do we get out of here, Tom?
We'll close the show with Tom's three keys to life, like we always do. Life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last, or I'm going to come and hunt you down. And keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And we'll see you next week.
This is Chad Turnbull, a lifelong Long Islander and the founder of Savorian Wines, a local import wine company. This week, I recommend Santa Francesca, a wine produced from Alto Alger. This region is home to another famous Santa, but without the cost for marketing in each bottle. Just added quality. Pick up a bottle of Santa Francesca at Bottle Buys in Glenhead, Bottle Values in Old Bethpage, Bottle Bargains in Northport, Bottle Hampton in Southampton, and Bottles and Cases in Huntington. For more quality wine suggestions, just email me, chad@savorian.com.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at AmanoRestaurant.com.